Hello, everyone. I'm Tucson Sentinel government and political impact reporter Jim Ninsel, sitting in for the legendary Bill Buckmaster here on The Buckmaster Show. It's Wednesday, May 15th, and producer Tom Fairbanks is across the window from me here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio. Today, we're going to be talking about immigration with attorney Mo Goldman and Casa Solitas executive director Diego Pena Lopez. And we're here with my colleague, Paul Ingram, who's been working at the Tucson Sentinel since 2014. Paul's one of the best immigration reporters in the nation and an extraordinary photographer. It's an honor to work alongside him. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
I mentioned you cover the border for the Sentinel, but sure. You do a lot more than that. Last week, you got a dose of tear gas sometime after midnight when you were at the scene when police moved in to remove that encampment of protesters who had set up near the U of A's main gate. This is the sort of on-the-scene reporting that's very important to our community. Talk about what happened that night.
Sure. I mean, that's probably the third time that I've got a little dose of CS gas at the University Drive, which is kind of a weird thing to say, but back in the day, there was the March Madness thing happening that the police used pepper balls to break that up. And then last week or a couple weeks ago, then Tuesday, they broke up the crowd using CS and rubber bullets. And they decided to come back. The group came back and took over the little corner of the U of A campus near the Olive Grove along Park Avenue. And they set up tents. They built themselves a little bit of a compound using wooden pallets and then some construction materials that they freed and set it up, and they stood there for a little while. They got a warning at 10:30, actually before 10:30, but at said with the idea that 10:30 they had to leave or that they would face some kind of action. Took police a little while, but right around midnight they set up. A bunch of Arizona State troopers created a line of skirmish, and they fired CS canisters into the crowd and started pushing people back with pepper balls.
And pushing them back out onto University Boulevard?
Yeah.
Was that the direction they moved them? Yeah. And what was the reaction? Well, obviously the reaction of the protesters was to run, but talk a little bit about why they were there.
They're really to protest that what's happening in Gaza, the way that the Israeli military has used force in Gaza. There's been a lot of civilian deaths. People are very upset about this. They're very furious about this, and they've really taken a protest. And this is part of a nationwide, even international effort that people have done over the time, which is really to camp on campuses and really take over those spaces and do that as part of a protest against what's happening. And protesters want the U of A to do something. They want the U of A to divest from certain companies, including companies that produce arms for Israel and also companies that are linked to Israel. And so they really, you know, push for those things. And the U of A has pretty much, at one point, when the first protests a week earlier on Tuesday, you know, there was some sense that the U of A would say, hey, we'll negotiate with you, but you guys got to leave at 10:30. We have a curfew on the U of A mall, U of A campus. If you don't have a permit, you got to go. And no, they stayed. And so that moved so that Robbins actually then announced that if you were here, you're going to face some kind of law enforcement action, and that may happen without warning. Now, whether that means citations or whether that means arrests, that has been kind of left up in the air a little bit. But that Thursday, Arizona State troopers lined up in a big skirmish line carrying riot gear, and then they had another skirmish line that kind of came down from the north along with two armored vehicles from the Pima County Sheriff's Department. And they started launching CS canisters, or you know, which are different, a little bit different than tear gas, but basically have the same effect. It's not fun. I and a couple other photographers got a big face full of it. So it will clear out your sinuses, but it's really painful. It's really awful. So people really, I mean, and if you really have to kind of get out of the way of it. And so some of the protesters, they wanted to tried to pick up CS canisters and actually throw them back at police. Some people threw water bottles with like a mixture of yeast in it, so it kind of splatters and covers windows or shields. And they threw that back. One person was aiming a laser at police, and at one point some photographers. And but the police kept up with these munitions until basically the crowd was really pushed all the way down University towards General Benz.
And was anyone seriously injured in the melee?
No, no one was seriously injured in it. A couple of people were arrested. That was early at the beginning of it, but that was it. No, as far as I know, I mean, no one was really injured by it. But I mean, you know, it's always tough to say, and you know, whether somebody took really like a baton round or, you know, pepper ball rounds, none of those things are particularly good for you.
Right. But no one came up to you.
No one came up to you.
You know, I mentioned we're here to talk about immigration mainly today. So let's shift gears.
Okay.
And we have really seen a dramatic increase in Border Patrol apprehensions of people who are crossing the border in recent years. And that's been accompanied by a change, I think, in the type of people who are crossing the border. I think 10 years ago, by and large, the people crossing the border were trying to find work in the United States, and they wanted to avoid the Border Patrol and being detained by the Border Patrol. But today, it's more likely that, that people who are coming across are going to want to surrender to the Border Patrol because they're seeking asylum. And once they are detained, they enter into the legal system. They're scheduled for a court hearing or an administrative hearing, but they're released and they're now here legally until their cases are resolved and they have a status. Can you talk about what's happening here with the shift?
Sure. And, you know, one of the things is this has been happening, kind of shifting over a long period of time. You know, yeah, you're right. I mean, when I really first started in 2014, it was largely people who were from Mexico who were coming up. Most people, sometimes, you know, but even then, in my first sort of big sort of shift in the border was really talking about unaccompanied minors. These were kids who came up without any parents or guardians and were released and couldn't be released in the same way that people are now, which are families. And so with the kids, you know, the agency really had to put itself in the position of kind of taking care of these kids until they could be shifted to another federal agency called OR, the Office of Refugee and Resettlement. And so that was the first sort of big shift already. And a lot of those kids weren't from Mexico. A lot of those kids were from the countries of Central America, this sort of northern triangle, which is El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. So that was already shifting. And then
they were kind of fleeing gang violence,
if I understand things correctly.
Parents wanted to get them out of that environment.
Right. In some cases, you'd have parents who were already in the United States who were trying to have their sons or daughters brought to them. In a lot of cases, it was parents who were sending their kids out. Then over time, through 2018, 2019, under the Trump administration, that really shifted to families. First, it was families from those countries. But you also see increasingly, you see people from Cuba, you see people from Nicaragua, you see people from Venezuela. And then over time, that shifted even more. And now, so I was in Lukeville in November, and that was, you know, somebody joked, it was like the United Nations. There were people from all sorts of places. You really had to go and ask, where are you from? And I met people from Sudan. I met people from Nepal, India, you know, and also Guatemala, Nicaragua, Mexico, et cetera. So that crowd has really shifted, and that crowd was really different. The question, though, is that they're all coming to seek asylum. They're coming in. They're looking for agents. I have this one time where I was in the border in 2019. I had a Mother Jones reporter with me. We were driving to go see the border where they were going to build the border wall. They hadn't yet. And two kids who were from Nicaragua surrendered to me because they thought I was Border Patrol. And so we ended up kind of hanging out, talking to them for a little bit in Spanish and giving them water and a Cliff Bar, which they didn't like the Cliff Bar, and and waiting for a Border Patrol agent to arrive. In November last year, there were 750 people essentially doing the same thing in almost the same place. They were all waiting, and we were all waiting in line and waiting for agents to transport them in vans to the port or to a little forward operating base that Border Patrol had built that they would start processing them. And then they would send them on buses up to Ajo, where the big Border Patrol station is.
And you were there, I think, this winter, during a pretty fierce winter storm, and folks had crossed the border and they wanted to surrender.
Right.
But Border Patrol wouldn't come and get them, and it was freezing rain. People were exposed to the element. Talk a little bit about that experience.
Sure. And so that was such a marked difference compared to what was happening in Lukeville. In Lukeville, there was a couple, half dozen Border Patrol agents. They had a FOB that they had set up where they were processing people. They were taking buses and vans and moving people. In Sasebo, we're pretty far outside of Sasebo. We're kind of in the desert, really to the east where the ranches are. And you have to keep in mind that there's all these massive hills. There's a border wall all the way across. But people had been coming through largely because they were coming from Sasebo. They were fleeing Sasebo because there was a kind of war between two gangs. And they had really started essentially taking over the town. And people were fleeing from that. So they came and they had nowhere to go. And it was freezing. It snowed the night. The night before I went there, then through the day, it had snowed. I went up there at night. It was freezing cold, and there were hundreds of people. They didn't know where to go. They didn't really know where they were. I mean, they knew where they were, but they didn't know what they were supposed to do next, and they're waiting for Border Patrol. For Border Patrol, they had a huge logistical problem. They couldn't get their vans up through the roads. The roads were wet and fairly impassable. And there was just this sense that Border Patrol didn't quite know what to do at first. They were surprised by it, and they didn't have the logistics or the men, and they couldn't process it. Can keep in mind that Sassabee has a tiny little port and it has a tiny little Border Patrol station. But the agency really didn't, and there was nobody out there. So it was all these volunteers from No More Deaths who were out there trying to take care of people, trying to keep people warm, kind of creating fires. They were bringing out pizzas and blankets and doing all these things to keep people warm. And, you know, I mean, I saw like a woman with her kids. She stripped off their clothing because they were all wet and they were freezing, and she replaced everything with warm clothing. And you watch this kid go from being a little bit blue, a little bit worrisome blue, to smiling and being kind of okay within about 15 minutes because of the stuff that No More Deaths did.
It just sounds like it was a horrifying situation out there. And we did have a caller on our previous topic who wanted to know if there were any numbers on how many were in the crowd on the U of A campus.
That's a really good question. I don't have a good count, because it's always tough to count groups of people, especially when it's a little bit dark. But about 60 were in the camp, I would say, roughly. Who had kind of set themselves up. And that includes all the people who were then kind of pushed away.
Okay. We are going to take a quick commercial break and have immigration attorney Mo Goldman join us. But before that, I just want to remind folks that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle. Mona's is located on the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise, open Tuesday through Sunday for breakfast and lunch, and you should treat yourself to their mouthwatering pastries, including the famous Danish Kringle. MonasDanishBakery.com or BuckmasterShow.com for a link to Mona's Danish Bakery. And we'll be right back.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is finalizing a new 20-year plan for RTA board review and approval to seek public feedback on the draft plan. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in Southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in Southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
We're back with the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. I'm Jim Ninsel, government and political impact reporter with the Tucson Sentinel, and I'm co-hosting today with Tucson Sentinel reporter Paul Ingram. Joining us now on the Rincon Ventures live line is local immigration attorney Mo Goldman. Welcome to the Buckmaster Show, Mo.
Thanks for having me on, Jim and Mr. Ingram.
Hey, Mo.
How you doing?
We have been talking here about the increase in asylum seekers who have been crossing the border. And you obviously work with a lot of immigration issues. Can you talk a little bit about what is driving these folks who are seeking asylum in the United States?
Well, it's obviously due to a lot of turmoil across the world. I personally get a variety of individuals that come through my office from all over, whether it be from, Africa, from the Middle East, from South America, Haiti, the list goes on and on and on, India. And when you look deeper into, some of the geopolitical problems and issues that are happening around the world, you really start to realize that we're living at a time where there is, a lot of oppressive regimes out there. You've got conflicts that are forcing people to become displaced. And it just draws people to a place where they're trying to seek a safe haven. And, obviously you have to combine that with the regular flow of migrants that are coming to the United States for other reasons, like economic reasons or to be united with family. But at the end of the day, the number of people who are displaced and fearful from going back to their country has, definitely increased quite remarkably over the last few years, several years.
Yeah, Mo, can you also talk about, you do a lot of people who are coming in for visas who are also seeking their citizenship. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what that process has looked like? It seems like there's a big backlog, in part because the court system has been really underfunded for a good long while, and there's just not enough, there's not enough sort of judges and attorneys and structures to make that happen. So can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Backlogs are everywhere, and it's primarily due to the poor laws and regulations and policies of the United States, in that, legal paths for people to immigrate to the United States are few and far. And ultimately, when you have, millions of people who are trying to legally process through a system that can take, in some cases, 20, 30 years or more just to legally process for somebody who wants to be here with lawful permanent status, it makes it more difficult for people to legally do it. And so, that ties into our, huge increase in undocumented people in the United States, because we don't have the legal paths to get here. So when I see, somebody like Eli Crane introducing a bill that would reduce those legal paths that are already, pretty much limited, I can say flat out that that's not going to help matters much. It's going to increase the flow of people trying to come here without legal means. And so what we should be doing is creating more legal paths. And then when it comes to asylum and courts, we're already at like 3.2 million cases in a backlog. We don't have a lot of judges. And so, with the fear potentially of having a president that's going to try and add on, 10, 15 million more cases, there won't be any end in sight in this process.
And what do you think that people maybe don't understand about what we're seeing at the border, because the media's not really doing a good job?
I think what people don't really get is that we have, and some, a lot of people understand it, but they just don't want to admit it. I mean, we do have obligations under our treaties and our own laws to protect people who are seeking asylum. So if somebody gets to the border and they say, you know, I'm afraid to go back to my country, they are given a process, and a process that includes a credible fear or a reasonable fear interview, depending on their specific circumstances and background. And then ultimately, most of them get referred to an immigration court for a hearing on their asylum. So when I start to see that the current administration is trying to change some of their regulations to make it tougher for migrants to seek asylum, I really am concerned, because if you give some, you know, people at the border more power to reduce, you know, individuals coming here to seek asylum through their own decision-making and discretion, you are potentially eliminating that process, that due process that people should be getting under our laws.
All right. We have a hold on, Paul, because I know you have a follow-up, but we have a sure. caller on line two, Rick, who has a question for you. Let's bring him into the conversation.
Right. So I have more than one question, but so asylum seeker, 30-year-old man from El Salvador, lives in a bad neighborhood, born into a bad neighborhood, gang violence, criminal violence, eligible for asylum, yes or no?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is that if they're eligible for asylum, it's really about whether they have credible fear. And that's just really a question.
No, political asylum is, so I was an immigration officer for over 13 years.
Sure.
Political
yeah.
asylum is for somebody that, like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was in the gulag in Russia, who is a dissident. It's for somebody that has a fear of the government, not a fear of Jose down the street that runs a gang.
Yeah.
That's an abuse of the asylum system. And there's on 8 billion people in the world.
And so let's give Mo a chance to respond to what
you're... The other factor that plays into it...
We're short on time, Rick, so I want to give Mo a chance to respond to what you had to say.
Go ahead, Mo.
Yeah, and the fact that the court will look at, or the asylum officer, is whether the government is willing and able to protect that individual. So, you know, when we look at, like, I have a case right now where there is a situation where one of my clients was in a relationship with a member of one of the cartels in Mexico, and that guy was basically controlling the prison that he's in and dictating, you know, the attacks that were being made on his partner, and the government was not protecting her because the government was complicit in the acts of this, you know, horrible gang member. So then I think what has to be looked at is, did this individual who was attacked go to law enforcement? Did they ask for assistance? Have they tried to prosecute them? I mean, it's a very case-specific issue, and I will say that a lot of people that are trying to get asylum have a really hard time getting it because of the lack of evidence. That's the ultimate problem, is that, you know, if somebody comes here and they're saying, well, I'm afraid to go back, you're going to have a lot harder time if you don't have, you know, some proof that you were threatened, or that you were in, you know, medical care because you were harmed, or that you tried to make attempts to report the crimes that were not being handled by law enforcement. So, I mean, it in a general sense, I think, you know, Rick has, you know, made a good point, but at the end of the day, that is something that has to go through, you know, some form of analysis by, you know, both the Immigration Service and a judge.
And I think Moog makes a good point. I mean, this is something that goes through the immigration part, the judge's part, this isn't something that's decided at the border. This part of the border is really whether you sort of have these standards, whether this makes sense, and then you're moving on, you're processed through and then sent forward with a notice to appear, which is up here to go to the court. Whether or not you lose, win or lose your case doesn't necessarily affect what happens exactly at the borderline.
And at this point, both the administrative officers and the judges are pretty backed up with cases.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, in some places, like I went to court in Phoenix yesterday and we scheduled a final hearing for one of my clients, and he got April as his final hearing date.
Okay.
So, just give you an example of how far out it is.
All right. We have to take a break for the news. I want to thank Mo Goldman for joining us today, and we'll be back with Diego Pina Lopez, who is the executive director of Casa Elitas, a way station of sorts for asylum seekers who are passing through our community.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade. Using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana. Plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. And your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. I'm your guest host, Tucson Sentinel government and political impact reporter Jim Ninsel, and I'm filling in for Bill as he takes a much-needed break. With me in the studio is Paul Ingram, a longtime Tucson Sentinel journalist and one of the best immigration reporters in the nation. And we are going to be joined in this segment by Diego Pina Lopez, the executive director of Casas Elitas, which serves as a way station for asylum seekers who are passing through our community. But first, we have a little love for one of our show's longtime supporters, Green Things. Since 1970, Green Things has been the go-to place for your gardening needs. Green Things is on a lovely 13-acre site that is also home to the Zocalo Village and all of those fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things is on River Road, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, and on the web at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. And Paul, while we're waiting for Diego, let's talk a little bit about Casa Solitas and really how it came to be.
Sure. I mean, Casa Solitas is a long-running organization, but it really has come into its sort of modern era, I want to say, really in 2019. And that really happened under the Trump administration. Lots and lots of families were coming across the border. They were being picked up by Border Patrol. They were being processed, and they were being released as they're required to under law. And there's a complex layer of laws that really guides how this happens. But really, Border Patrol is just has the ability to hold all these people. So they release them. And they released them, and what they had started doing is releasing people, several years ago, they were releasing people to the Greyhounds bus station, which the old one, not the new one that's over on Broadway, but the one that's kind of downtown. And they were putting people in there, and of course, two things happened. Of course, the Greyhound didn't want to know what to do. Greyhound bus station and folks didn't really know what to do. And it was very clear that lots of these people were families with kids. They didn't have anything. They didn't really have any money. They didn't really have any food.
They may or may not have spoken English.
Well, they usually don't. And they may not even speak Spanish. They might speak some of the other languages that run all the way through Central America. So these folks who Casa Solitas really kind of stepped in. They were all volunteers, and they stepped in and they really started trying to help people, which is direct them what buses they needed, food, water, little things for their kids, blankets, whatever they needed. That effort really expanded over the last several years. And in 2019, they started doing this sort of shelter at the church, the St. Benedictine Monastery that's over on Country Club, and they were really keeping people there. One thing about the Benedictine Monastery is that that building was never really designed for lots and lots of people. It was designed for a few nuns, actually, I want to say, and it just wasn't there. So in 2019, the county, Pima County, stepped in.
And the owner was working on a redevelopment
and
of the property.
Right, and that's great, exactly. And it was open. But even in the meantime, it just wasn't a great facility for that. And so in 2019, Pima County wanted to step in using money that was from the DHS and CBP to help support people. And so they created shelter spaces to really help people and to get people moving on. They spent about $77 million, all in federal dollars that have come through the county, that has been spent to really help people as they move from the desert into Tucson and then kind of mostly elsewhere. They go all over the place. I mean, you see, if you look at the map at Casa Solitas, you'll see people going all over the place. They're going to Ohio and they're going to Florida and they're going to Texas and they're going to New York and they're going to Washington and California. A lot of them, they're really not staying here. This is, as you said, a waypoint.
And here is Diego Pina Lopez, who is the executive director over at Casa Solitas. Paul was just explaining kind of the origin and what goes on there. But you really see people from all over. They're only staying here for a short time after their release from detention. And you're helping them get to the next spot so that they're not lost and confused and on the streets of Tucson as you try to figure out how to get to wherever they might be going.
Absolutely. As Paula was saying, people are going to all four corners of the United States and really coming from all four corners of the globe seeking refuge and services. One of the challenges that we see is, meeting each person as they're coming through the door and recognizing the needs that they might have. Medical issues coming through, a family member being separated while they're journeying through the desert, while they're in the process of immigration. And we give them time, respite to figure out their next steps. Most people that come through leave within 6 to 7 hours. A husband and separated from the wife might stay longer because of not wanting to leave their wife here or what have you. Medical issues that arise too, dehydration, particularly this time of the summer, blisters on the feet, giving them a chance to reset and know that they're in Tucson and move forward. Well, as I mentioned, many leave within the same day and the next day.
And I think one of the things that a lot of people misunderstand are these are not illegal immigrants and undocumented people. They are here with a legal status once they are released from the Border Patrol detention.
No, I mean, absolutely. If you just start with that, right? They're being released from Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol. They're coming to us with immigration paperwork saying that they have a court hearing in their destination, and there's that expectation. Every person that we provide services to has that piece of paperwork. That's how we get funding, and that's how we keep operations and the lights on, is making sure that those people are coming to us and they're moving to their next steps.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's really important is to think about, especially when you have all these people from different nationalities, you also have to deal with languages differences. I mean, how do you handle that, and how has that changed from you know, 2019, when you really kind of started the first kind of county processes, to today?
Matt, you know, I think back, I've been within Alitas for 10 years, and thinking to the first time I met a woman from Romania and her talking about being back home for the first time after fleeing, and thinking it was back to being a safe space. And she talked about her husband having a glass bottle broken on his head, and how they only did a surgery that was $5,000, only $3,000 worth of medical services, and thinking about the displacement and the stress that she was going through. And I don't know Romanian, you know? And then now last year, I think about this time last year, we were seeing many people from Mauritania. Wolof is a common language there, and French. But sitting across the table with somebody who was just enslaved 7 years ago, and they're still their life experiences, it just blows me away. And a lot of the work that we have to modify, because we never know who's coming through and the population changes, is really like finding who speaks the other languages, changing and modifying our paperwork, oftentimes in a couple of days or week, and then working to see about cultural competency with the new cultures coming through, and what is going on globally to lead them coming in our direction.
And you guys nearly had to shut down a few weeks ago when the federal funding dried up, and at the last minute some funding appeared, and you, I think, had already been in the process of winding down the operation. What is the impact when, or what would have been the impact if you guys had closed?
We were looking at letting go of about 2/3 of our staff, right? And then seeing our footprint drastically go down to the Ajo location of roughly 100, 120 people per day there at the most. You know, financially, resource-wise, we were looking at more at 40 people per day. Having said that, the footprint, the experience that we would see in Tucson would be children under the age of 3 and their parents street released in Tucson, and anyone above that on the streets, about, you know, 3, right now would be 300, 400. Back when we were looking at this, we were thinking upwards to 800 to 900 people a day.
And folks who don't speak the language and are trying to figure out how to get to their next spot, and no resources available.
Yeah, people that don't, you know, most of the people speaking Spanish, some French, Mauritania, all these different demographics just being dropped off in the middle of Tucson. The concerns that I have was to see some of the worst of our community coming out at that point. People taking advantage of people who don't understand the value of currency in the United States. Those medical issues that would not be served, and then the situation that would arise as those people are getting situated.
And your funding now, how much, how much longer do you think the current round of funding will allow you to keep your doors open?
The current rate of funding should keep us going for the rest of the year, at least. You know, we made a lot of modifications, provisions to be more lean and strong. I think right now, too, is we've seen a dip of the numbers. Last year was the first time in 10 years I've seen a surge in numbers for the summer months. And right now we're seeing it go back to normal, if we can call it that, about 400, 600 people per day. But that could change at any time. It really depends on the policies within Mexico and all these other countries that are now seeing people coming through the doors.
Yeah, one thing that I don't is really tough to understand, I think, is how much the other countries, all the way down through South America and Central America, there are lots of countries that are taking in immigrants. They're hosting people, Costa Rica, Colombia, even Mexico. I mean, you know, Mexico has lots and lots of people who are actually staying in Mexico who would come from, you know, Venezuela or other countries. So, you know, there's lots and lots of people who are doing this, but Mexico as well, and then all the way up through the United States. So, you know, that the dynamic is really, really messy, I think, right now, and it's really complex. There's lots of different moving pieces, and I think it's hard to say exactly what happens this summer. You know, we really do see a seasonal change. We do see that, you know, numbers are dropping. You know, Border Patrol the other day said that they had about 7,300 people that they had apprehended over the week, and that was dramatically down from about almost 11,000 that was happening the year before. So this situation may have changed. On the other hand, it may really shift again. We don't know. It just depends on where people are coming from.
All right. We have caller Rick is back with another comment on immigration. Rick, what would you like to say?
So my question is this. I know Brazil very well. I spent 2 years in Brazil, had a Brazilian girlfriend, really loved Brazil. Brazil's population is in excess of 200 million. Let's say that at least 10% of the population lives in abysmal conditions, below the level of poverty, well below the level of poverty. Should we allow those 10 million people, let's say in the next 12 months or 14 months, to come to the United States because they live in miserable conditions? I've seen it. I had a girlfriend that lived in a favela the favela is extremely dangerous. I remember being awoken in the middle of the night to gunshots, a series of gunshots just outside the window.
Okay, let's give Paul and Diego a chance to respond to that.
I think Rick is asking a good question. You know, if everyone, there's millions and millions of, I want to say there's 22 million people who are displaced around the world who are moving all over sort of this place. And that's why I kind of bring up Central and South America. You know, we also have to remember that there's African countries that are hosting people from other African countries. You know, there's just a big shift. And that's not talking about, of course, Europe, where, you know, which is also complex in its own way. Yeah, I mean, if everyone who is poor and who has real problems decides to sort of pack up and march north, sure. The one thing, of course, is that hasn't happened yet. You know, I mean, you see, well, it's the people who are in Venezuela. Venezuela has had a really massive economic decline. They've had lots and lots of problems. You do see lots and lots of Venezuelans who came up through Mexico. You also see lots who went to Cuba. They went to other countries. It's really, really complicated. I mean, it's always complicated. You say, can the U.S. take so and so many people? I mean, one thing you look at, like a country like Costa Rica, by population, they've accepted more people than we have. So, you know, in that way, Costa Rica has accepted more immigrants. But on the other hand, if you know, 5 million people or 2 million people decide that they all want to set up and they want to go, that's really complicated. But, you know, you have to go back. I mean, right, Rick, you mentioned you were an asylum officer. I mean, of course, the United States has laws and strictures that it's agreed to. And there's also court strictures that it's agreed to, things that a Border Patrol can do. So we have to figure out how to make those things work. And we have to figure out how to make the bigger problems and figure out where people are coming from and why they're leaving.
I couldn't say it better than Paul did right there. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, as I remember people coming from Venezuela a little bit over a year ago talking about the police parading people to prison and saying, you're next, the parade of people there, and then moving to, we're going to kill you, is the transition there. You know, the people that are experiencing that poverty in Brazil, that there's a lot of other things and nuances that could come, and maybe some of them do. You know, we've seen people from the past Brazil coming to us, but not nearly what is going on. And a lot of times we see the demographic changes based off of what is going on globally. And I think it goes back to what Paul is saying, is that complicated web of what our policies look like, what are the policies and experiences for these people to leave their home countries. I don't know very many people in the U.S. or anywhere that would leave everything that they hold of value just because of a bigger paycheck necessarily. I think we have to look at all those circumstances and how we also empower other countries to support in the work and also recognize what needs to change in those home countries.
Speaking of supporting the work, how can people help Casa Litas? What do you guys need?
Oh my gosh, that's a great timing. You know, we're seeing a lot of our winter visitor volunteers leaving us right now. And one of the big things is to see additional volunteers coming through, you know, staying well informed about the policies, what is going on. I know there's a lot of things coming up that could change the work that we're doing, and to stay informed with that, as well as, you know, donating is always helpful. If you have some gently used clothing goods to give, we can definitely use that as well. And you can donate at casalitas.org.
All right. Can you stick around till next break? All right. Well, then I think we are going to go ahead and take a quick break here, Tom, for our final segment.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation improvements in the region, averaging more than $100 million in tax revenue each year. The RTA is preparing a new 20-year plan for public review prior to a May 2025 election. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
And we're back on the Buckmaster Show. I'm Jim Ninsel, the government and political impact reporter at the Tucson Sentinel, filling in for Bill. With me today in the studio is Paul Ingram, who is my colleague at the Tucson Sentinel, who covers immigration along with about 18 other beats, and we appreciate that very much. And Diego Pina Lopez, who is here to talk about what goes on at Casa Salitas, the way station for folks who are seeking asylum in the United States, have been adjudicated through the Border Patrol, released, and then are headed to their next destination. Paul, you have a question for Diego?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I thought was really interesting is, you know, when there was the funding, there was going to be a funding lapse, but the county got some money, but they got about, I want to say, they got 21 million or 22 million, and that was fairly low compared to what they asked for. They wanted 48. So that carries you through the year, but how does that really work? I mean, how are you going to be able to do the work that you've been doing through the rest of the year?
You know, it's very dynamic. Right now we're seeing about a third of the people that we were seeing previously coming through. And we've been seeing the numbers relatively lower about in Phoenix and our other partner agencies. So we're able to adjust so we can keep our costs down overall. But if the numbers jump, say, in September, November, that drastically decreases the length of time of our operations. But that also, you know, looking at April 1st, as we were talking about earlier, about the funding lapses, I made a lot of changes to try to save some dollars wherever we could. And I think there's still a lot of opportunity for us to do that as a collective. But it's all about, you know, making sure that the families are taken care of, supported, to be able to move forward. And then recognize if the surges come, to be prepared to adjust and pivot in that way. You know, I think upwards I was running 3, 4, 5 shelter spaces across the community. And it's really built off of people and working as a collaboration with a lot of different NGOs and groups here.
We should talk about what the facility is like for you. You're still with the county facility?
Yes, we're still operating right now out of 2 county facilities. You know, our main location is kind of the spoke where we're having most of the families coming through and doing the initial assessment if there's any medical issues, any additional needs of support with a missing relative, and language services. And then from there, they are dispersed between our other location or locations, depending on the volume of people. And that's been really effective and a great model, I think, for the rest of the U.S. has looked at on how to prevent the street releases. And I think that's another key thing to mention is we are still the only area in the country, knocking on wood, that has never had street releases. And that's something I'm really proud of and I think our whole community can hang a hat on because we've been able to pivot so well over time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in part of what's you've been able to do this since 2019, I mean, this has been kind of a long-running thing. So can you talk about, I mean, what's really changed in some ways between 2019? Is it really just the numbers and the people coming for, or are there other things that have actually changed the dynamics here?
I mean, I think about, you know, starting in a 5-bedroom house in operations in a lot of the grassroots of the community at the Greyhound bus station off of I-10 when I was back there in the day. And I think one of the things we did very early on was, you know, moving to technology, doing intakes within a computer. A lot of other larger shelters still do things by paper in the country, which blows my mind at times. But, you know, when in Rome, right? But then the second thing is, too, is we've modified our practices and the partnerships across the board to recognize, you know, if there's a medical issue, we can send it to partner A, partner B for the mental health issue and so on. Mm-hmm. And that's been a great asset and support to move things forward. I think when the numbers got higher, too, is recognizing what tasks, you know, to empower the guests more and more to be able to move forward faster. You know, on a regular basis, I look at the Tucson airport. I have volunteers working there now. And that's been very supportive to make sure people move faster, too, is if we miss something here, that they're able to get additional support at the airport.
What would that be? What would that look like? What would be something that somebody would need at the airport? I mean, besides, you know, maybe the process of how to get on, what do they need to do for to fly?
Exactly. And I think that's a big one there is, you know, recognizing how to go through TSA, making sure they have the passport, if available, and the immigration paperwork on hand. And then, you know, how many people coming through forget about the water bottle as it is from the U.S., right? Imagine all these folks coming through with that kind of issue. Educating them on that, taking off your shoes, the basics of making it through the airport. It's a pretty complicated process if you think about getting on an airplane for your first time. And then, you know, we're working with partners also at Sky Harbor. We send several buses there a day, have people ticketed and ready to go. And I think it's that complicated network that we've been able to weave by doing this for so many years and building such a large collaboration here.
You know, one of the things you talk about the other shelters that are actually kind of involved. I mean, at one point there was, you know, people were going, being taken to New Mexico. Lots of people were going up to Phoenix. Can you talk a little bit about how that network kind of looks like?
Literally, it's one of the next text messages after we finish today. I'm meeting with our partners in New Mexico because, you know, we might be funded, but there's still challenges across the board with this federal funding. Mm. And, you know, some of the shelters right now had to slow down or shut down entirely because of the struggles with the SSP transition for funds. And having said that, you know, it's kind of the whack-a-mole of collaborations, talking to folks to make sure that we identify, okay, how many buses can we send to Phoenix to IRC, International Rescue Committee, who's receiving there at their welcome center? How many can I send to Las Cruces to Border Servant Corps? And to make sure that we can keep our numbers down and save our funding, as well as helping them maintain a level of busyness to keep their staff busy and going well.
One of the things I think is really... Go.
Unfortunately...
Oh, we're out of time.
We're out of time. We're out of time. I want to thank you, Diego, for coming in and telling us more about what's going on there. I want to remind our listeners that our friends over in Silver City and Grant County are ready to welcome you back with open arms, and it's just 3 hours east of Tucson, and there's a lot to do in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, where there's plenty of social distancing, if that's still your thing, and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of many things to do and great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. I want to thank my co-host here, Tucson Sentinel reporter Paul Ingram, as well as our guests, immigration attorney Mo Goldman and Casa Alitas Executive Director Diego Pena Lopez, as well as the team here who keep things running so smoothly in Bill's absence. Join us tomorrow when Ryan Hansen will be in, take over the mic. Thanks for listening and have a great afternoon.